All right, well, good morning to everyone. We are continuing this week in our study in the Worldview series, number 5, where we've been considering together basic worldviews that have been offered and continue to be offered on the, if you will, the grocery shelves of the ideas of men. And we opened our series considering what is a worldview. And again, we go back to that basic definition. I hope if I give you a quiz next week that you could write this definition down to some degree, that a worldview, and maybe that's a heads up, maybe you'll get a quiz next week, a set of basic beliefs or presuppositions about the world seeking to answer three basic questions. Without looking at your notes, what are the three? What's that? Metaphysics, all right, metaphysics. The question of what is the nature of reality. Somebody else? Epistemology, which is? Okay, good. How do we know? What is the nature of knowing? What is sufficient to know? And then? Ethics, or the way we put the question, how should we then live? Yes, that's very, very important. How should we then live? Because a lot of people have an answer to how we should live, but the question is, how should we then live based on these two things, as Schaefer points out? Okay. Now, over the past several weeks, we've gave an introduction to Christian theism, and then we looked last week at deism, and you'll remember that two of the differences, and I'm sorry that the graphic didn't turn out better. I should have printed it out in a higher resolution, and it wouldn't have been quite as hard to read. But notice that when we spoke of theism, the basic metaphysical claim is there's the cosmos, that is all that is, all that is created, and that there is a God, there is the God, who is infinite, that is, He is separate, transcendent from the cosmos, from all of creation, but also He is personal. So He's not only infinite, He's also immanent, so that God is present everywhere. This is basic Christian theism. And then we saw the next major worldview, what we could put God little g, and this God is infinite, He is the supreme being, but then cosmos, I'm putting a capital C here, cosmos here is little c, cosmos here is capital C, and what I'm trying to indicate there is that God in this worldview has shrunk, and the cosmos itself, a natural revelation, has increased. Okay, so this is deism. We saw last week that God is, in this worldview, infinite. He has created all things, and that all people have within them the light of knowledge and reason and understanding. But now that God has set the world in order, and it is running on the laws, basically the laws of the cosmos are all that's really directing or in any way moving the cosmos toward any kind of a direction. God is now standing afar off, and He's separate from the creation. Now this week we come to a major jump, but we'll also see that it is a progressive or digressive of this perspective. Whereas God is big G here, little g here. Here, God does not exist. There is no infinite God, period. So God is diminished to the point of non-existence. The cosmos, notice, has gone from little c to big C, and now, as Carl Sagan would say, the cosmos is all that there is. And this would be basic, what we would call naturalism. What's that? He doesn't say that. So there is theism, deism, naturalism. Notice how the cosmos has increased to where now the cosmos is everything. God has now decreased to the point and diminishing to the point of non-existence. This is historically, though certainly others would hold varieties of these views, in the Western world culture, this was a process historically. Yes?
One quick question on the first view there of theism, would we say that Islam is basically theistic, they believe in one God?
Where I would differ, where I think
how would it differ from that? It,
right there. Yeah, the personal, the aspect of the personal God in Islam, you have a prophet who is a mediator, but he speaks on behalf of God. God never comes as a theophany. God never came in the flesh. And that's where we would say that Jesus Christ is the ultimate aspect of God's personality, of being personal and entering in. He himself came in the likeness of sinful flesh. That is as personal as you can get. Whereas Islam looks at that view of the Son of God becoming flesh as abhorrent and blasphemous. There's just no way. So Bahnsen describes Islam as a form of Christian heresy, is what they would say, what he has said from that. And I think it's true. It's general theism, but it's not Christian theism. And I think that's a big difference between, because this is you can't sing Children of the Living God from an Islamic view, like we just sang. Okay, so you'll see the definition then I've given of naturalism, which is from the American Heritage Dictionary. I think it's a good definition. The system of thought holding that all phenomena can be explained in terms of natural causes and laws without attributing moral, spiritual, or supernatural significance to them. Basically, again, the cosmos is all that there is. Everything can be explained by natural processes or processes. Now, this isn't just a matter of fact, the result of the rise of the theory of evolution, but there's a shift philosophically between 1600 and 1750 before Darwin comes along. This is taking place philosophically before Darwin comes along. Matter of fact, I believe that Darwin, probably having this perspective, then has an agenda to prove, and he does that through the sciences that he tries to do so. So philosophically, this has already taken place. And such men as René Descartes, though a theist by confession, he conceived of the universe as a great mechanism of matter. So he was already moving in that direction. John Locke, he believed that God, given reason, was to judge what is true. So he is somewhere moving in this direction already in between the 1600s and 1700s. And then, I'm not sure how to pronounce this name fully, Julien Alfred de la Mettrie, stated, quote, "It seems to me that the greatest degree of probability is in favor of this belief in the existence of a supreme being." But he goes on to say, "It is a theoretical truth with little practical value." So he is now diminished philosophically God out of existence. Is he there? Maybe. He actually says, "I think the greatest probability is that he is, but that if he is, it has nothing to do practically with us and our universe and our world, how we should live." So these men philosophically were already headed in the naturalistic perspective. If you go back so far as Thales and some of the other Greek, some of the poets and some of the Greek philosophers before the time of Christ, around the time of Isaiah, around that time, some of them have already taken and adopted a naturalistic worldview, where you have the Jews. And I think it's a mistake, and Bahnsen points this out, a mistake to say that philosophy starts with the Greeks, because there is a philosophy in the Old Testament, which goes back historically a lot further. Job has a philosophy about life. Abraham has a philosophy. There is the infinite personal God who reveals himself and says, "Abraham, walk before me blamelessly." There is already philosophy, but it's interesting that when philosophy books start out with the Greeks, that's already a presupposition. It's as if nobody did philosophy up until then. They, in fact, discount religious philosophy altogether. And that's a presupposition. Okay, so you have at the time of Isaiah, Isaiah has a view and a philosophy of God and the world. You have the Old Testament, which talks about when they see rain, they see the hand of God. When you see the sunshine, you see the hand of God. There's a metaphysical philosophy behind that. But the Greeks come along, and at least some of the early Greeks did not believe in the mythological set of gods, so some of the poets would develop that. Some of the Greeks themselves would try to explain that all things are ultimately one kind of thing. And so you have one Greek philosopher that said, basically, everything is water. And so he would propagate that if you could boil everything down, everything is basically water. But then there would be a philosopher after him who would come and say, well, there are things that don't have water-like properties, such as rocks. You don't see rocks having water-like properties. You don't see sand does not have water-like properties. So where they were saying everything is one kind of thing, the next guy came along and he said, well, it can't be any one kind of thing that we can define. It has to be some, and they wouldn't use this language this far back, but some subatomic particles. There's some basic building block of the universe. As far back as the Greeks, before the time of Christ, there is a form of naturalism where there is no philosophically higher being or purpose or ethics or morals. Everything is from the cosmos. Everything is either eternally existent or came into existence through who knows how. So that's just to say that historically this goes back a lot further, but in the Western world culture, particularly post-Renaissance, you would have this rising in kind of this general flow. Yeah, Rick?
This is not to say that there weren't atheists going further back.
No, that's right.
You know, read the full head sentence part of God.
You're right. Absolutely. Yes, that's right. That's right. As the writer of Ecclesiastes says, there's nothing new under the sun. Okay, so let's consider then, as we look at these basic three questions from a naturalistic worldview. First, again, the answer to the question, what is? What is the nature? What is metaphysics? What is the nature of reality? And you'll see several propositions that I put there in your outline. And if you don't have one, the bulletins. Does anybody need a bulletin with the outline on it? Didn't get one? Okay. All right. So here are several propositions from the naturalistic worldview. First, matter is all that there is. Matter or substance of some sort, whatever the basic stuff of substance is or material, is all that there is. Strictly speaking, there's no mind above and beyond nature. They would go so far as to say, and we'll see this when we look at the nature of man, that even our mind is not something above nature, but our mind is merely the result of chemical processes that are going on in our brain. So that a person's beliefs or a person's thoughts or a person's convictions, you could actually, if you knew exhaustively about human nature, you could get in there and figure out, and you could tamper with that, and you could actually change people's beliefs by changing the compounds in their brain. So that all that it is the outcome and the consequences of material. There is no soul. There is no soul. No. Soul, I mean, what is a soul? You can't put a soul in a test tube. That even, and they would describe it differently, but even the sense of the soul is merely the result of the unique makeup of man as he's evolved into a soulish creature. And all of them won't take it that far. But even the idea of a soul or a spirit or even of mind as something that is apart from my material substance does not exist. There's no no, and we'll see that when we get to the issue of death. No.
It's kind of like your foot going to sleep. You feel a tingle when that happens, and if you have any feelings of anything beyond yourself, then that's just sort of chemically generated.
Yes, love. Love is a process of the chemicals in you. When you feel your love and your heart flutters towards your wife or towards your husband, all that is the chemicals in your body reacting to the instinctive nature of wanting to propagate your species. That's it. There's all there is. From the shape of a person's body, from the what we esteem as beauty, it is nature's mechanism to cause certain hormones to kick into to gear, and it's purely a physical. You don't have love as we would conceptualize it in a Christian manner. It is all a response of the material chemicals in imbalance in who we are. So that you could say, as we'll see, some people are more affectionate or less affectionate, not because of a higher principle, but because the chemical makeup is that way. And we'll see, it's a part of the machine, the mechanism. There is, again, from this worldview, matter is all there is. There's nothing above. There's nothing beyond what you can put in a test tube. Even idealism, or, as we'll see, absolute as far as any kind of morals, all that is off base. Everything, if you knew the body, and they'll be humble enough to say, we don't know everything. So something of the sense of justice. Justice is only a result of this. It's nothing of a higher sense of justice. There's no sense of anything other than what comes out of the H2O and the oxygen and the water and the particular chemicals that are in my body and functioning particularly in the brain. So if there's any seat of the soul, it's the brain. And it's only the brain as seen as a series of chemical reactions. That's it. And we'll see some of the consequences of that in just a moment. The second thing is, metaphysically, matter is not only all there is, but matter has to be eternal. Because if material is not eternal, if it had a beginning, then you have no prime mover, you have no creator, or you'd have to have a creator, you'd have to have something from which matter comes. From a naturalistic worldview, matter doesn't just appear. That's absurd. It cannot happen. So it follows that material has to be eternal. And that's why cosmos becomes a god, in a sense, that it is the only eternal thing. People aren't eternal. Ideas aren't eternal. Material alone is eternal. It gets into some problems as far as energy and the second law of thermodynamics. How do you explain, if matter is eternal, that the cumulative energy of the universe, most scientists agree, is declining? And if it be declining eternally, we would already be burnt out. The second law of thermodynamics is basically summarized that the Earth is, or that the world and the cosmos is dying very slowly. It's expending energy, but by the expending of energy, like if you take a ball and you bounce it as hard as you can, it'll bounce, but when it comes down and it falls again without an increase of pressure and of energy, it will eventually bounce, slow down. There's not a perpetually bouncing ball. There is this bouncing to the point of ceasing, and that's the universe. The universe is running itself out. So that's one even philosophical, if not scientific, problem is if nature is eternal and energy is eternal, and then there are different theories of how perhaps it compresses to the point and then explodes again over billions of years. It compresses, it explodes again, and somehow it's regenerating. But even that, you would still have to come up with an idea of energy not being what's called the law of atrophy, of things breaking down. Tony, did you? The intelligence has no origin. I mean, there's not intelligence in the way that we would think of it as something that stands apart from material.
Well, I mean, by observation, construct, order.
Yeah.
That
they would have to say it's merely the outcome of billions of years of evolution, and it's just how things happen to be.
Time plus chance.
Well, I know. I don't think there is either. But that's what they would say. And they would say it in terms that would blow my mind. They would say it in such ways that I couldn't even understand it. But we're trying to boil it down to its basics. I'm not seeking to misrepresent, but boil it down as basic and simple as possible. The theories of how this can be, I think it could be said, have been tried and then discounted, put into the trash heap. You try another one, and they're still trying, and they admit there is this problem. This problem has not been solved, but they say we would rather adopt this and accept its problems than to adopt this. That's the bottom line. It's a presuppositional commitment. Okay, so matter is eternal. Matter is without beginning. It has always existed in some, though possibly different, form, yet matter in and of itself is just is eternal. The origin of the universe is said to be some unknown event of a self-activating process of eternally existent stuff. That's the bottom line. It's self-starting. You ask, how can something start itself? There's no answer. There are a number of theories, but I don't think anything that has satisfied even the scientific community on that level. So you have the Big Bang. You have you know, a number of other things that have been postulated, but there's nothing, there's, I don't think there's a universal consent even within the scientific naturalistic community, at least from my understanding. And I'm no scientist, I'm more of a philosopher, so that's not my field of expertise. And neither is philosophy, I'm just an amateur. So, okay, matter is eternal. There was no prime mover, no supreme being, there is no intelligent design. There's a self-moving power coming from no one knows where, and it just keeps on going, though science itself says that it's not going, but it's actually dying. Third, matter is directed by a system of cause and effect within a closed system. Matter is quote-unquote directed, and even that is not, I think, a sufficient term, because when we talk about directing, it sounds like somebody personal is in control. Even when you speak of the progress or the advancement of things by evolution, that gives ideas which I don't think are fully embraced philosophically. So you have all this, the stuff, the substance, and that somehow, as each step of the way, billions of years goes, that it's more and more organizing itself into things or into people or whatever, that there is, rather than a continued scrambling, that somehow out of that process comes order. There comes eventually intelligence in the mind of a person, that we are the most advanced at this point of the human race, but that every part of this advancement, there's no director, there's no direction ultimately other than chance. I mean, it's like throwing a pair of die over and over and over and over, or shaking a puzzle, or you know, you've heard it said that you know, you take a bunch of typesetting and throw it into a press or something, and then stamp out something, and it's just jumbled. Well, if you do that billions of times over and over, eventually perhaps you'll get a whole page of Shakespeare or something like that. That theoretically, probability-wise, you do that billions and billions of times, probability says that may happen. And so that's why the time scale of evolution has to be so humongous into billions of years, because they admit that in a short period of time this cannot happen. So it has to, you've got to keep throwing the type in billions and billions of times over billions of years to the point where, boom, you get order. Now, the interesting thing is, as I think about it, is you stamp out, even if you got a page of Shakespeare at that point, you throw that type in randomly the next time, you're not going to get the next page of Shakespeare. You're going to get random again. Yes?
Do they believe that we have perfect order? Because, I mean, you have to have, you know, in order for everything to work together, they have perfect order. But, I mean, by nature of the universe being called the cosmos.
I don't think they would define it as perfect, because there are still anomalies. There are still problems within the universe. There's still chaos that can be, in some degree, observed. There's still sicknesses. There's still Down syndrome. There's still things that are abnormal in the sense of... So I don't think they would say it was perfect.
So there's a lot of words on the page, but there's still some
glitches, perhaps. Yeah. And from a Christian worldview, we wouldn't say things are yet perfect either. Because the world has fallen, the world has sin, and that's the explanation for it. Yeah, Katie?
How does evolution fit into the Christian deism?
Well, evolution is the process of billions of years of time plus chance plus matter. Without a personal creator, wouldn't fit. Christian theism would admit the scientific evidence for microevolution, that there's no question that things develop and things evolve on a smaller scale. But as far as macroevolution, that species develop eventually into other species and other kinds, that's what would be rejected, that man came from an ape, that we have evolved to a higher consciousness. We were once a fish, then we became eventually an ape of some sort, and eventually became a man. That's where macroevolution would be rejected. But the fact that things like moths and the birds of the Galapagos Islands and some of those things that are observable, that through, if you will, natural selection, that there is a survival of the fittest or of the most fit within a certain environment. We admit that. That'd be dumb not to admit that. Tony? Yeah, adaptation, microevolution. So that there is process and there is order. There are mutations. Which is interesting, in the evolutionary worldview, mutation, from my understanding, again, this isn't from a scientific mind, so mutation is part of the process of developing higher. And if I understand correctly, most mutations that are seen in a controlled setting are actually degenerative rather than advancing. So you have a mutation. Again, I'm no scientist, but I'm getting a lot of heads nod and a few nod, but yeah.
I think you can easily make the statement that every mutation that you do takes a step in the wrong direction.
Okay. And Janice, where what kind of experience does that come out of? What is your background? Okay.
George Shatt, who is up for winning the Nobel Prize, I took quantum physics from him, and his theory of the Big Bang, I mean, it definitely is more toward a religious belief, because it would go against the law of entropy, for example, that everything tends towards disorder.
Right. I think I called it entropy, but it's entropy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but that's wrong. Yeah.
And so entropy. they definitely start with the belief that there was something.
Causation. Yeah. That has set things in motion, and that's where we are on this point. That matter is directed by a system of cause and effect within a closed system.
And now there are these crazy anti-matter explanations that atheists have, but it's more of a belief too,
Right.
And there are some Christian theists also who would believe in some kind of theistic evolution.
Yeah.
That the days in Genesis might represent great epochs of time.
Yeah, the day-age theory, that each day, each yom in Hebrew is actually a long period of time, so on. Right. Which I think it's Hagiograph, it says, God is awful wasteful. If that be the case, if it takes him billions of years of trial and error and mutation, to get us to this point, it seems like God is wasteful and just, it takes him almost, why couldn't he get it right the first time? Why couldn't he just why can't he just go, if he's really in control, why can't he just organize and deal and do that? Janice?
And one of the strongest arguments against a Christian view of evolution incorporated at all is we can't have any death before Adam.
Right.
Adam was the first man.
Right. And that's where philosophically you can't fit this in, because what she's saying is the Christian worldview is death came as a result of Adam's sin, that even the creation itself, according to Romans 8, even it is subjected, not willingly, but unwillingly, as a result of Adam's sin. And so if that's the case, it actually undermines to embrace evolution philosophically, import it in the Bible. There are some incredible philosophical problems, one of which is that Jesus believed in Adam and Eve. And that will seriously undermine the accuracy of his words, and that he was the Son of God. Because if he was mistaken because when he's talking about marriage, in the beginning it was not so. And he speaks of Adam and Eve as real people. He speaks of Noah as a real person and a real flood. So he's referring to those things. So you can't embrace it as far as macroevolution without undermining at the same time the deity of Christ. You just cannot do that. Unless you take the perspective that he was merely, speaking in their language and culturally and just didn't want to deceive them or didn't want to lead them astray, so he just spoke in the mythology that they were used to. But again, that seriously undermines the integrity of Christ.
And then you've got other things too, where man is set apart in the image of God, distinct from the rest of creation.
Right.
Formed from the ground, not from the fallen animals.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and from that theory, from Christian theistic evolution, you know, if we take the Genesis 1 and 2 seriously, you have Adam and Eve here as beings created in the image of God, but you have to have some pre-human creatures that were yet not created in the image of God, as far as almost humans, maybe slumped over a little bit or something, who were not conscious. And you have to have billions of years between their evolution and the actual coming of Adam and Eve. So again, that gets very tenuous. It gets difficult.
Even the distinctive appearance of Eve herself,
you know, the way she was created. Yeah. But see, all that cannot be. I mean, that's not even set forth as a possibility, because that assumes a personal God who creates and who can ever even take a woman out of a man, out of his rib. I mean, that's Sunday school mythology. I mean, so we are not going to accept that. It de facto, presuppositionally says that cannot happen, therefore it did not happen.
I mean, all
miracles, yes. And that's what we get to here as we look at matter directed by a system of cause and effects. Miracles do not happen observably because they cannot happen. From a Christian worldview, and where I stand as a Christian, I don't see miracles, so I have to explain that by saying that we must not be in the age of miracles. Maybe they are. I don't see them. But I would say they do not happen because God does not will them to happen. From a naturalistic worldview, they cannot happen, therefore they do not happen. Everything, again, has a natural explanation. Any claim otherwise is necessarily false. Let's move down to number 4, because this is where the rubber meets the road, I think. Humanity is a part of the system. As we see the mechanism of the universe directed, for lack of a better term, the chaotic stuff, eventually building blocks of the universe, and eventually, through perhaps a fish and then a gorilla, then you have the evolution into man. Still, from this perspective, humanity is a part of the system. There's no other, there is no higher order. There is no higher moral. There is nothing other than the system itself. So this is true not only of creation in general, but also for human beings. We are a part of the machine. We are a cog in the wheel. As a race, we are just a part of the evolution of this great machine. All that people are is what they are. Right? Because if I happen to be Stephen Gamble, and what I am is a process of evolution, including all the chemicals in my brain, and unless I perhaps use LSD or some other chemical enhancer or hallucinogen or whatever. What I am in my essence, down to what I believe and what I think, is a conviction of, if you will, the present combination of things in my brain and in my experience. I have no other experience other than my own. I have no chemicals in my brain other than what happens to be there at this very moment. So all that I am is the heap of building blocks. There is no mind above that. Mind and ideas are the effect caused by chemicals. There is no other. Pierre Jean Jorge Cabanis, 1757-1808, he says the brain secretes thought as the liver secretes bile. And that's consistent, that thought or mind is not something separate. It is the secretion of the brain. Have you got that?
But he's saying it's a chemical.
Yes.
Thought is a chemical as opposed to something natural.
Thought is the result of chemical. Right? So you got the liver. It secretes bile. It is a chemical response to what happens in the liver. So likewise, the mind secretes knowledge, or not knowledge, but thought. And that's a very, very important point to understand.
This idea about that was similar to the creation of file. I'm not sure that he could have trusted it.
Well, it's, and he would say ultimately you shouldn't. Yeah, and they would, from this worldview, would have to say, and that's what we're going to get into. What this moves into is what is called despair. That to what? Well, no, Hitler was never neither right nor wrong. Just Hitler was, and what he did was, and whatever is right. They would consistently say that Hitler was a process of this. His thoughts were the outcome of his particular chemical makeup and experience, and in a sense, you could not have had otherwise. He's a part of the machine. He's caught in the machine. There's no way to pull out of the machine. There's nowhere to pull out into. You can't go anywhere else. You can't make decisions other than what the process of your brain are. Now, we're going to see that that's denied strongly. But from a naturalistic worldview, it does not follow. And we'll see that, I think, in a minute. G.G. Simpson said, "Man's intellectual, social, and spiritual natures are exceptional among animals in degree, but they arose by organic evolution." So what happens is everything like love, intellect, purpose, thought, law, all of these various things, to seek to prove this, the animal kingdom has gone to try to find lesser degrees of these things. So you'll observe monkeys or dogs or mosquitoes or whatever, and what you attempt to do is go back and find something that looks like love and say, okay, well, if we can find it here, then we're just evolved to a higher degree of that. What looks like intellect? What looks like purpose? Such things as art or abstract thinking. What is attempted under these controlled environments is to go back and look for traces of that in a lesser degree anywhere. And if you can find that, then you've got an explanation. Well, this particular species of moth has this characteristic, therefore we have it, just greater in degree. Okay, so there's nothing unique other than, there's nothing. It's the difference between a guy that works out all the time and a guy who doesn't. They've got the basic same stuff. One just happens to have used it better, so he's bigger and he's buff. The other guy's got the exact same muscles. I mean, he doesn't get a muscle transplant. You know, he comes in the next day. He has just evolved, in a sense, by the use of those things to a higher species or to a stronger. Same thing with the mind. Someone smart or somebody not so smart, by and large, though there are abnormalities here, it's someone who's exercised their mind and tried to press beyond that. But again, all of these things are imported back into the animal kingdom. If we can find it in some degree there, I mean, woohoo, we found it, look, that means we're just evolved. But I would suggest that things are just not that tidy. And you have to work awful hard at it under controlled environments or environments that you're interpreting. But even things like abstract thought, how can you demonstrate abstract thought in creatures? I mean, because it's thought. Yeah?
I was going to say that in animals you see things like grief, when a mother bear grieves over her cub or something like that, you sort of see a sense of love in animals.
Mm-hmm.
More the abstract thing, the artistic thing, is completely non-existent as far as I can
see. Right. Well, and that's just because the process of intermediary species have died out and we happen to survive, whereas the lower species haven't. That's what they would say. I think that's what they would say. Jan?
I think that's the driving force. You've seen a lot of, the parrot that was on the news that can speak 900 words. Have you heard of they spent our text and research trying to teach animals how to talk?
Oh, yeah. Yes. If we can demonstrate that, I think that's the thing. Then we can somehow justify that this is the case. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Okay.
And something else too that was helpful to me some years ago in working through this is that there are certain basic building blocks in all of creation that God uses, where there is overlap and similarity between us and the animal kingdom.
Yes, absolutely.
So we need to be careful about where we draw the line.
Good point.
And listen to distinctively human.
Good point.
And this is, generically animal.
Yeah.
You know, we can see some, as Randy pointed out, expression of emotions mm-hmm. of different kinds with animals. My dogs are always happy and wagging their tail and, you know, love to see me and very affectionate seeing me. But, you know, for me to say, well, humans can have this, animals can't, we need to be careful before we draw those lines.
That's right. And that's why, even from the Genesis account, God makes everyone after their kind, and then He makes humankind. And so God doesn't make a completely different kind of creature, but there is overlap. There's the recognition that you look at the development of the fetus. Are there similarities? Yeah. Sure. But is that surprising? No. God created all these things, so you're going to see similar fingerprints on the things that He created. I mean, that's not like...
And use similar mechanics, so to speak,
right.
and working with different things. And also, that's a great benefit to us.
Mm.
If we're to rule over creation and have that dominion mandate that was first given to Adam, then there's got to be some kind of consistent principle throughout
absolutely.
The world that meant.
And again, going back to what we saw with Christian theism, we do admit man is, as it were, in the middle. From this perspective, this doesn't exist. Man is only creation. And then at this point, we're not saying that this is all that there is. But yeah, we developed. There is microevolution. There is adaptation. Sure. It's no problem with that. Tony, did you have your hand up? Yeah. Well, and even speaking of architecture, I think two of the strongest observations dealing with the issue of morality, also with the issue of art and of law, that as we'll see, there are some of those things that are, I think, uniquely so. And I'll try to give an example of that in just a moment. Let me move on, Randy. I'm sorry. We've got about 12 minutes. Let me give you the option. We're pressed for time. Go ahead. Okay, all right. Okay, number five. This follows: death is extinction of personality and individuality. There is nothing beyond the grave. What I am is a particular makeup and soup of material that happens to exist now. When that ceases to exist, I exist no more. I mean, that's easy. That follows. Ernest Nagel said this: that human destiny is an episode between two oblivions. So his view is. And the naturalist view is, before I, me, Stephen, came to exist, I did not exist. I suddenly exist. When I die, oblivion. There is no sense of purpose other than what can be seen. I'm a part of the machine. Once I die, there is nothing else. There is no self-consciousness. Death is an extinction. With removal of life and the disorganization of my particular material nature, there is no one, there is nothing. The loss of one who is loved is merely a loss of their effects on your life. You don't lose the person, in a sense, because the person is just like a tree, perhaps more highly evolved, but the grief that a person feels at the loss of a loved one is not the loss of the loved one, but only the loss of the influence of the loved one on their life. Right.
That's not lost.
Right. It's the difference between tasting strawberry ice cream and being told you can, and you really like it, and it really tickles your taste buds and everything, and being told you'll never be able to taste that ice cream again. That a person's influence on another person's life is just the taste. So that when that person goes, there's no grieving of the loss of them. What you're really grieving is a very selfish, self-centered thing. It's like being told you'll never get to taste ice cream again, and you cry and you sit around, you weep about, oh, I love strawberry ice cream. But it's not the loss or the mourning of an individual, but their effects on you in particular. Number six, history is a linear stream of events linked by this cause and effect. No purpose, no meaning, no direction intelligently like we would think about it, that it's a linear, material substance is eternal. But when you put all these individuals and human history together, it's just quite foolish to think about meaning and purpose. I mean, that's not a question that should be asked. You can ask, what happened? But it's really not valid to ask, why did it happen? Because why begs for a question of purpose. And in this worldview, there is no purpose. There is no direction. There simply is, as the result of billions of years of things smashing into one another and mixing up with one another, including people. Don't ask when somebody dies, why? Just ask, what happened? Well, their heart stopped. Well, that's interesting. Okay. Well, I'm sorry that they're not going to be around because I enjoy their presence, but oblivion. They cease to exist. They're gone. And this is where we'll see the next philosophical step is despair. And this is the culture in which we live. And it's moving toward despair. And we'll see how some of that is worked out. Number two, epistemologically, how do we know? Again, as we've seen, all knowledge is by empirical investigation, observation, and experiment. There's nothing else to know. And the search for knowledge or truth outside the chemical universe is futile and just silly. It's like chasing after myths. It's just not allowed. You can't import anything beyond material nature into this worldview. If not, you're just living in a pipe dream. Now, number three, how should we then live? Now, the question here is primarily, what is the ethic consistent with the system? Not, how do the naturalists live? Those are, I think, different issues. The question is, out of the system, the metaphysical and the epistemological, that's why I emphasize, how should we then live? You've got these two questions. Based on these things, even to ask how should we then live? What's the answer? Consistent with the worldview. Why do you think that?
I think their argument would be more pragmatic, you know, if you're experiencing a drought and you build a reservoir or dam up the river, you know, because that's what works. You know, if you want to keep people from acting barbaric and destroying one another, then you create walls. So it's a pragmatism that runs there.
Utilitarian or pragmatic? Ultimately, you look at the system that presently exists and you say, how can I minimize my pain? How can I minimize my sorrow? How can I maximize my pleasure? Again, those are merely physical categories. How can I not go to jail where I'm going to be deprived of certain things that I want, like company of people that I have a chemical response to? You can't say love in that sense. I like being around these people. How do I not have my strawberry ice cream taken away from me? How am I not made to eat mush? And I'm going to then come up within the societal norms of where I live in my culture at my time. And here I am, and I need to look around and figure out what do I need to do to maximize pleasure and minimize pain or discomfort or displeasure.
That point of view is really well illustrated to me when Commune with Strangers. Mm.
I haven't. And what is it again?
It's called The Stranger.
The Stranger.
I would have to say, why would I even want to live? Why would I stick around if
God, it's not, you don't ask why. Remember, why is not allowed.
Well, then I'd just check out.
You would have the freedom to do so.
Exactly. Because other religions, you see.
Well, that's it. Right, right. And the thought of non-existence seems less attractive than the point of existence in eating strawberry ice cream. So why? Why check out?
But the cold weather feels cold, and the hot weather feels cold, and if you have arthritis, it feels painful, and all that kind of stuff.
Right, right. And that's where you have, when things get bad, if non-existence is better than that, then you just have Dr. Kevorkian or somebody else conveniently take you out. I mean, that's just, there's nothing else. Even the question of why, from the worldview itself, the construct of the worldview, is just not an allowable question. It becomes, though there tends to be a social construct, ultimately it becomes the individual construct. It becomes what is, in a utilitarian way, most pleasant or pleasurable for me. And let me live within that system. If you don't like the system, go over to the New Hebrides Islands and live there, or to Europe or wherever, to fit in with the system. I mean, if you're more of a Nazi by philosophy, then go live in Nazi Germany in that time. Tony?
So I wouldn't argue with that stuff. I would just say we're probably
But again, it's a difference between what a person would say and what follows from the worldview. That is a humongous difference. Now, let me make the point here. Thankfully, there is a blessed inconsistency between the beliefs and practices of the naturalists. And that's what, from a Christian worldview, we would call common grace. They look at this, by and large, though I think some do move to despair, and it's clear in their philosophy, it's clear in their art, or if you would call it art, it's true in their poetry. It's true in a number of ways that are, I think, uniquely human. It leads to that way, but they stop and they go, mm-mm. And I don't even think a person will think that, because I've heard people say that this idea of what I'm saying here, utilitarian and pragmatic, they'll admit that, but then they can't apply it consistently. Because they still believe that there ought to be a sense of order and justice and law and punishment for things that are bad. They will still make judgment calls and moral declarations about right and wrong. I mean, if you talk long enough, you fall, and I found this again and again, somebody says, well, I hate it when these religious people shove Jesus down my throat. That's just plain wrong. Wait a minute. What do you mean wrong? Why is that wrong? That's what I am. My chemical makeup is such, why should you be offended any more than I have black hair? Well, it violates my rights by telling you my ideas and my beliefs. Well, you shouldn't be ugly. And we would agree, from a Christian worldview, you shouldn't be ugly. But if that's what I am, what's wrong with ugly? If I'm mean-spirited, how can you say that's wrong? That's how I've developed my ethics, to say that to advance my pleasure. Maybe I get pleasure in saying ugly things to people. Who are you to decide and determine that that's wrong? Well, it bothers me. Okay, I don't like strawberry ice cream. You're just telling me your preference. You can't say it's wrong. You say, I prefer that these religious people don't shove it down my throat. I prefer they don't either. But they begin to live thankfully, or this world would be awful, inconsistently with the worldview, to which we seek to graciously say, this doesn't match up. And by this you witness your love for art and love and purpose and meaning and abstract thinking and consistency and all these things. They're not rooted in your worldview. Man, you're sitting on God's lap and slapping Him at the same time. You're borrowing, this is borrowed capital. How should we then live is then borrowed from, I believe, a consistently Christian theistic. I know perhaps to some that sounds very arrogant, but it doesn't follow from the system. It doesn't follow from the worldview. according to naturalists, man alone has risen above the metaphysics. And there will be all kinds of theories of man rising above and developing a consciousness and a sense of order and a sense of uniqueness. And we are the most advanced. But metaphysically, how can that come? It doesn't follow. Well, we have morals, and there is a sense of love and of purpose. But you see, it becomes mythological. And there's a leap of faith taken here because it doesn't follow. There is a leap of faith to say, we can't explain it, but we know it's true. I do love. And I do have a sense of aesthetic beauty for certain kinds of things. I am deeply moved at the loss of a loved one. And I know it's more than chemical. I know that it's more than that. I can't explain it, but I reject your perspective because I don't like it. Not because it's not demonstrable or demonstrable, but there's a leap of faith to say, despite my worldview, I'm going to live differently. And I thank God for that. Because quite frankly, there are some very good atheists and very bad Christians. But that's not the point. The point is, what is consistent with the worldview at this point? There are those who have lived on all kinds of the spectrums, both bad and good. There is no evil, strictly speaking, but simply a matter of preference. And often within this perspective, there is the intelligentsia, there is the intellectual elite who figure out for any social construct how it is that they should then live. It's those who have got the enlightenment. It are those who are above and beyond the common masses who then say, this is how we should live together. And we should live within that just simply because it produces more pleasure than pain. Where does this sense of morality, though sometimes skewed, come from? Again, I believe it is the essence of us being created in the image of God, and you can't erase it. When you try to erase it, it ultimately leads to despair. I believe this is an area in which the naturalist is a witness against himself. There is the suppression of the truth revealed in creation, revealed in conscience, and there is a suppression of the truth in unrighteousness, as Paul writes in Romans 1. This is an attempt to intellectually remove oneself from the issues of being accountable to the living and true God. It is to raise up arguments against the existence of the God who will judge all in righteousness through His Son, Jesus Christ. And I believe that despite the arguments, God has said that they are without excuse. And because they rise above the creation, I think that is a very evidence of conscience, that they know what truth is. Because they're created in the image of God, and you can't eradicate that. You can't erase that. Well, let's pray. We're past time here. Thank you for your patience. Let's pray, and then I'll field any questions we might have. Heavenly Father, from the worldview that we've seen here, we think of millions of those that have been created in Your image, who, if following the worldview consistently from what we understand of it, would lead to a despair, a kind of hedonism, and a sense of, or a lacking of a sense of, a final day of accountability and judgment. And we are told in the Scriptures, where the knowledge of God is abandoned, that lawlessness abounds. And Lord, we thank You for the common grace that yet resides even in our unbelieving friends and family and workmates. Lord, we don't look with pride and arrogance. We don't look on them in a way to think of how superior we are or how much smarter or how much more spiritual. But we look and we are moved with compassion, O Lord, at creatures made in Your image, who are so trying to suppress that image and explain it away. We ask for Your mercy. We ask for the grace that we might speak in a way that is compassionate, which is convincing that there would be a power and force in the truth itself, or that we would not be ugly when we speak it, but we would speak with conviction and love to see creatures made in Your image fall in love with You and to seek You and to pursue You and find redemption in the Lord Jesus Christ. Father, anything that's been spoken that's inaccurate because of my own failings and my own lack of study or inaccuracies, Lord, would You please blow upon it and
Lord, may it not hold any water whatsoever, but whatever has been true, use it for the good of your people. Use it for the good of all those present, Lord, to stir up in us what you've implanted. For you've said that you put eternity in our hearts. Lord, may we seek that. May we long it, we plead. In Jesus' name, amen.